This is Birth to Work Radio.
Try to convince a community that had always felt if you had a strong back, you could always make a decent living. That disappeared, but the same people stayed in the community.
The competition is much more prepared in terms of the knowledge base and the expectations, and we have to get there very, very quickly.
The problem with education in America is a problem of trying to use a bureaucratic form to do what is basically a cultural and moral mission.
It's important for business leaders to recognize they play an important role in the vibrancy of the community.
I always felt that as a pediatrician, I was also an educator because the trust that people have in us.
We know that when parents know their children are in an academic crisis, they will move mountains.
The most important thing for parents to do is spend time in human interaction with children.
My goal as a community leader now is to create responsible, engaged citizens. I have to emulate what I want them to do.
And now, here's your hosts, Elaine V. Scott and Rick Stevens.
Hello, this is Rick Stevens with Birth to Work Radio, and Elaine Scott. Elaine, through the wonders of technology, is in the Huntsville, Alabama airport. She'll be joining us by cell phone. We have a terrific show lined up today with Dr. Alberto Gettisman, a pediatrician in Orange, California. And I think you're going to find that Dr. Gettisman brings a rich perspective and insight for parents, doctors, business leaders, about the important role that healthcare plays, particularly in early childhood development. To get the dialogue going, Elaine, would you please describe for our audience how you and Dr. Gettisman first met?
Absolutely. Hi, Alberto.
Hi, Elaine.
It's so nice to talk to you again.
Same here.
I was so thrilled at the opportunity. I think it's interesting that we actually didn't meet around the issue of pediatrics in a formal sense. Do you recall how we met around the issue of media literacy?
Yes, I remember very well, and we had a cappuccino together while we talk away about the importance of educating doctors and kids about media literacy.
And I was so taken with the fact that in your role there at the hospital, you were administrating and carrying on with children and families and looking out for them, not just in their physical health, but in their mental and mental growth as well, and the impact of all things in the environment. And I believe you were also engaged and involved with safety issues, the American Pediatric Society programs, and working a real entrepreneurial sort of what I'm going to call an approach to helping both the hospital and your patients manage the care of children. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think it's fair. At the time, I was involved, like you said, on educating physicians through my leadership role with the American Academy of Pediatrics local chapter here in Southern California, and also involved with the major injury prevention program that was financed by tobacco tax money.
And those programs reach well beyond the traditional role of what many people consider the role of the pediatrician. But you had a special spirit inside you and something that motivated you to go beyond that. And talk to me a little bit about that and help our audience understand how you saw your role as a pediatrician.
Well, I always felt that as a pediatrician, I was also an educator. Not only of my patients and their children and what they represent the future, but also of educating other physicians of the importance of community and the role that we play because the trust that people have on us. And it's not only about providing help to the sick, but it's also providing help to assist the development of healthy human beings.
And you had, I hear that and I saw that and it was just absolutely rich, the kinds of things that you did, especially in terms of connecting up so many different doctors. And tell me, and help me understand, and therefore helping my listeners and our listeners understand that it's not given that just because something even appears in a magazine or an idea or a thought, that all doctors automatically know about it. That's something I think people really don't realize about the doctors in the medical field. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's very fair to say. Medical schools have been for many years dedicated to train physicians on the art of medicine. And then the training of physicians in hospital, the demands for service are so huge that there is very little time to devote to other issues that are related with medicine. Therefore, issues like community assistance or issues like leadership roles and business, because medicine is now a business in this country, all of those issues are very superficially touched in all the training programs. So when young doctors come out to practice, they're very well trained and very capable physicians to deal with physical health, also with mental health, but they know very little about the environment, the business environment. They know very little about the advocacy environment, the community, and how to assist communities in getting their people healthy or on a preventive healthy road. And that's why it's important to energize these young physicians and try to get them to do these things. And fortunately for us, in every generation, in every new group of physicians, there are a few that follow that track.
And your contribution to that was, I know, was very, very profound in and around the hospital community where you were engaged. And I just want to acknowledge you for that, because I couldn't talk to anyone in that area of Orange County, in that area, who did not know, you know, who you are. But you changed in terms of your focus after a while. You made a decision to move on from where you were and to cultivate another area of research and development. And I would like you to begin addressing that a little bit and talk about why you did that and what you're doing today.
Basically, what it is while I was in my role at the hospital, I noticed that the number of obese children coming to the clinics was increasing dramatically, and there was nothing set up in place to take care of this problem. So we started a program on how to ease the burden of treating these patients and at the same time offering them a solution to their problem. And I realized at that point that unless a center was created that was fully dedicated to this issue, not much could be done. Funding was not available, and all the disciplines that were needed were not necessarily available in the hospital environment. So I used the opportunity that my contract was ending to move on in a different direction, because I always felt as a professional that, and you stated it before, I felt that I owe the community in which I practice, and the community in which I'm practicing is now having an overwhelming problem with obesity in their children. We are, Southern California is now one of the places where cities have the largest number of obese children. And so that's how I embark in this. And this is what I've been doing full-time for the last 3 years.
And in response to that, you turned around and Rick and I asked you, so would you have a look? We've been fascinated by what you're doing and have been proud and pleased and grateful that you've participated in the work that we're doing. You took time to read the book, our book, The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, and you made an interesting comment. Can we just getting into the notion of community? And you commented, do you remember what you said about it, that if we just took out the word business and put in the word...
No, refresh my memory.
You said if you just took out the word business and put in the word medicine...
Oh, yeah, I always say that. I always say that. It's just you have to look. Medicine now is no longer the art of healing, but it's a multidisciplinary profession where business is playing a big role.
So people need to be versed, and if we took out the word business and put in the word medicine in the book, the book would be exactly the same issues.
Correct.
People are struggling. People are trying to figure out what the way is, and they're trying to figure out how to manage this entire world of sorting through insurance and all sorts of other issues. But you have managed to put together a clinic that helps people not only diagnose, but train and develop teachers and train and develop parents to truly help their kids. And that for me is the extension of years of practice, which I think is amazing.
Well, I practiced pediatrics for close to 30 years, general pediatrics. But I think that if you look at the setting up of the center that I created, the most formidable task was to get funding for it and support. And the local Medicaid plan for children here was really very interested in what I was doing, and they were the first ones to listen to what I was doing, and they are now funding the care for a significant number of kids in a population that needs help. So I think that perhaps my best accomplishment after serving and providing services to these kids and their families that needed so much was to persuade a health plan that this was the way to go to prevent further injury and higher cost. So you can see the relationship between business and medicine.
Exactly.
Because actually the persuasion that I had to use to with the health plan was not only based on science, but was based on solid business rational decisions. Like if you invest now in the care of these patients, you're going to save in the future, and you're not going to be, being that this is a public plan, you're not going to be responsible for criticism made, because this is coming in the way of obesity. This country is facing a big wave of criticism years down the road, because very little is being done now.
Let's come back to that right after the break, and we want to continue that part of the conversation. We'll be right back. This is Elaine Scott, Rick Stevens, and Alberto Gettysman. We're returning now to a conversation with Dr. Alberto Gettysman, a practicing pediatrician in Orange County, California, for over 30 years, who moved out of the formal practice of day-to-day pediatrics into a very specialized focus on the needs of kids today as it relates to obesity and lifelong wellness. And in the course of this conversation, Dr. Gettysman, we know that there's a tremendous amount of demand that is placed on the role of the doctor, the pediatrician especially. We know that parents as a whole tend to rely more on the pediatrician between the ages of about birth and, or maybe even, you know, as they're going through their maternal care, but especially birth to about age 9 or 10. And I wonder, is that an exaggeration, or is that an accurate statement?
No, it's a very accurate statement. Actually, the American Academy of Pediatrics defines pediatric care, the kid pediatric care, is from prenatal to the age of 21.
No.
And many pediatricians in this country are taking care of kids that are past their teen years. So loyalty to the pediatrician sometimes goes after the kids grow up, and that was my experience in my practice. I had very grown-up kids in college that felt very comfortable with my care. So most pediatricians in this country have a significant number of kids that are past the teen years that are still visiting them. And what also something that occurred to me is that I had these patients of mine brought me their own children later on, which was quite a compliment, you know. And pediatricians are very trusted individuals, and they provide much more than just medical care and vaccinations. They provide guidance. They are a source of security in terms of physical, mental health, education, and other issues that keep coming up as the generations advance. Now, currently, parents are dealing with the issues of internet. cell phones, technology, invasion of their kids' private spaces, and separating the kids from the parents. These are new things, and who are diverse individuals? It's going to be the pediatricians, not the general doctor.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, see, we watch that with great concern because we see that professionals are being routinely intimidated by parents and by people who come to them for care, but then if they don't give the parent and the child the kind of care that the parent thinks they should have, sometimes it's even culturally specific, they become annoyed, aggravated, and sometimes even aggressive about reporting them or accusing them. And it intimidates professionals today in education and in business and now in medicine if they don't. If the doctor doesn't do what they ask them to do, did you ever find much of that in your practice?
Not really, because we always try to, in my practice or when I was in the hospital, we try to always be culturally sensitive. And I think that the physician-patient relationship has to be based on education and trust. So the first stage of relationship between a doctor and his patient is to make sure that trust is built, and in order to build trust, you need to educate. I think the more informed the patient is about the doctor, and the more informed is the doctor about the patient, its culture, and its community, the more successful the relationship is going to be. Not always, what I just described, is not always easy to practice because the demands imposed on time and volumes. More and more, the medical system is imposing doctors to see patients like every 5-10 minutes, and that does not leave much space for what I just described before, to be culturally sensitive and educate patients. I think that as we move forward in reforming medicine, which is something that needs to have in this country, we are going to develop assistance to physicians that are going to be able to provide this kind of service. And so by the time the physician gets to see the patient will feel very comfortable with the system and will have the trust that is needed, whatever their culture or community in which they live.
Well, your remarks are very, very important as we look at the role of the doctor and the medical care professional in the community. And again, I think we're in our work, we're igniting the energy and the soul of people who live in the community. The role of the medical doctor, and especially in From Birth to Work for us, is just critical to helping people really understand that a sole focus on just the wellness of the child from the body point of view limits the opportunity to see the child as a whole developing person. And I know how important their whole perspective can be. When I had my daughter, I had both my children at home, and the first time when my first daughter was born, I went to a pediatrician. I had an appointment with a pediatrician by chance, just to have set up a post-birth follow-up, but I ended up walking in with my baby in my hands, and the thing I remember most about it was that I was immediately criticized. I was told that that was not a good and careful thing to do, and there was something wrong with her, and she needed this and that, and I finally, he didn't ask me any questions at all, and I finally said, thank you very much. I left, and then I went to a second pediatrician who was educated outside the U.S., and when I went to him, he looked at my baby, and he looked at me, and he said, you're both so beautiful, I'm not sure I can stand it. Keep doing what you're doing, and come back and see me in a month.
And I know your daughters, it worked well.
Thank you.
You did very well, Elaine. Your daughters are beautiful.
Well, thank you, but again, how would I have known? You know, how would I have known, except to trust my instincts as a parent, as a mother, and just know that the first doctor had said you need to give this child water and you need to do this and that and tell me a bunch of stuff, and not that any of it was going to harm the baby, but it drove a wedge between me and the baby and said what you don't know as a parent. And I think what I'm getting at is that I wanted a doctor, you know, I wanted a pediatrician, I wanted my health care provider to trust me as much as he wanted me to trust him. And I didn't have that sense. And so tell me about the medical training or the kind of thing that helps doctors understand? Is that just individual? I mean, I'm not really clear. Is it individual or is it something that
no,
is
No, I think it's a little bit of both. I think, unfortunately, I hope that doctor that you hit at that point was an exception. The curriculum of education of doctors now includes cultural awareness.
Okay.
But I think that the role of a physician is, like I said before, in order to build trust, you have to educate. I would never accuse you of doing something wrong until I become very familiar with what you're doing, who you are, and the best way that I can talk to you. And I think that that particular physician is a very good example of how poor a physician can be if he doesn't use education and trust. On the other hand, I think that the majority of physicians that are concerned will always be inquisitive and like we are taught, and this is current, we are taught in medical school to first listen and observe the patients because most of the questions will come from that and not from anything else. You know, it's 70-80% of what you get comes out of the conversation that you have with the patient when you're taking the history and the examination that you do. And then the rest will come from all the technology that we have around. And so,
okay, well, I'm glad you're answering the question that way, that he was probably more the exception than the rule, because we're moving into a process right now that we want to talk about with our listeners, and we want to welcome and embrace your feedback. We've talked about this. You and I have gone back and forth over something similar to this, what I'm about to talk about, for over, gosh, 10, 12 years, and it has to do with the broadening opportunity to educate parents about brain development, about community engagement, and about the role that the external environment plays in the development of their child, not just how to go buy toys and how to change the baby's diaper. and Rick, do you want to talk a little bit about that and what we've done with Ronald McDonald House and our hospital association there in Chicago?
You raise a great point, Elaine, and particularly about the work doing with Ronald McDonald House, beginning to pull together, you know, community stakeholders to create a program aimed at really helping educate parents about the important role that they have in early childhood development. Because after all, parents are, in fact, the first educators. And being able to pull in not only those who are actively involved in childhood development, which includes the parents and how we help them, but also the hospital and the healthcare profession, but also aligning, you know, the key members of the community, whether it's the things that go on in the community, whether it's the local library, the local museum, and really creating a network that allows parents to go look and say, where are the best places they can go to help, you know, their child, but at the same time, you know, be involved with this, you know, the important elements about what really goes on physically and physiologically and psychologically in childhood development in these early years. And maybe when we come back from the break, we can expand upon that a little bit more and talk about the important elements that the parents really need to be involved and engaged in after the discussion.
The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce by Rick Stevens and Elaine Scott is winning accolades as an accessible business novel with a striking new perspective about community collaboration and workforce development for the 21st century. In the book, community leaders in the fictional town of Chantilly learn why they must think and act differently to build a sustainable workforce for the future. Real stakeholder leaders from around the country have used the book as a model for their own communities. Vicki Hogan is president and CEO of the Vermilion Advantage in Danville, Illinois. She and the Vermilion team have been collaborating with Birth to Work to implement the strategies outlined in the system.
Your book is really incredible. It's like a roadmap that in story form really sheds the light on a national issue and makes it obvious in a story form who the key stakeholders really have to be to create sustainability.
Sustainable results will only come from collaboration, alignment, and integration of the people, programs, and ideas of a unified community. The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, shines a light on the challenges that communities across the country are facing right now and the forces that drive and influence people's behaviors. Stakeholder leaders such as Angela Phillips-Diaz are using the book as a guide for effective stakeholder action. In her work with the University of California, Riverside, she's charged with improving the college-going rate in the region.
I literally have the book on my desk and use it as a reference tool all the time. It's been invaluable to me.
This system, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, is the guide for stakeholder leaders who want to do business as usual in a new way. Buy it today at birth2work.org or amazon.com.
Well, welcome back to Birth to Work Radio. This is Rick Stevens with Dr. Alberto Gettisman, pediatrician in Orange, California. We've really had a terrific dialogue, mostly between Elaine Scott and Alberto. Elaine's at the airport. She had to drop off the call, so I'll continue on the dialogue that we have here today, which to me has just been terrific and really insightful on so many things that go on in the healthcare, particularly as it relates to parents and their young children, the involvement of pediatricians, and the terrific work that Alberto is doing and really providing some great leadership for many of us to follow. You know, Dr. Gettisman, you know, as we closed the last show, we had a discussion about some of the things we're doing, beginning to work with Ronald McDonald House Charities in being able to create a program, you know, for parents to help educate them about all the things that they can do as first educators as their children begin to grow, but also how they can take advantage of, you know, what goes on in the community. You've seen a tremendous amount of change over the last several years, you know, particularly with the continued increase in media. And I know when you and I first met, one of the things that Elaine, you know, brought into this discussion was the whole notion about a media diet and discussions, you know, subsequent to that to nature diets. Could you maybe give our audience a sense about what those are about?
Yes, it's very important to realize that the researchers have worked for at least the last 30 to 40 years on trying to identify the relationship between media and children and the influence that they have on child development. And there is plenty of material that has been validated by several national organizations that prove that there is an influence of media on the brain development, and there is an influence of media on child behavior. That is not like it used to be claimed all the time that media imitates life, but media, in the eyes of the scientists and researchers today, media can influence life, not only imitate life. And for example, in terms of what I'm doing now, obesity, there is no question that the time spent by children in media is time that is taken away from physical activity, and the continuous bombardment by the media on trying to get the markets of children, teenagers, and younger children more and more, it's influencing the way these kids are eating, and the nutrition has been affected, and hopefully we'll be able to revert this. So I hope that this is giving you an answer in terms of the influence of media in children. Parents have a great influence on this because they are role models, and their media diet seriously influences the media diet of the children. The average American child now sits in front of a TV or a screen, whether it's a computer or a video game, 4 to 5 hours a day. It's about half the time that they sleep and about 75% of the time that they use in school. So I don't think it's something that is going to be conducive to a very well-prepared group of adults that are going to be conscientious about their health, their well-being, and they're going to be actually, like I tell my patients, that they're going to pay our Social Security.
Well, certainly that's a huge challenge. Also, probably a huge opportunity for parents to recognize, as you say, countless studies, countless evidence to talk about the impact that the media has in so many ways. You talked about certainly the impact from a wellness standpoint and obesity, but you also talked about the impact on brain development. And what I think I heard you say is, you know, media, while interesting, is really having, you know, potentially a negative impact on early childhood development. And I've seen research that says, you know, that it's not getting all the synapses closed properly, not because necessarily the media, but children aren't engaged in the multisensory input necessary to get the brain development that's so critical in later life. Is that true?
Very, very well said. It is very important to know that and this is also being proven by research over and over again, that the brain development of an infant, and it may even start before, but I won't venture that, it may even start inside the mother, where the child is already exposed to sound and motion and so forth. But let's talk about from birth on, the critical thing for brain development on human beings is the interaction with other people. And by using media to entertain kids, or by using media in some instances to educate kids, and I educate kids, but I'm not going to talk about the programs that are being developed for infants, because I believe that all these programs, the role they have is the role of babysitting. By removing the human component from the brain development of an infant, your parents need to understand that they're doing a lot of damage, because it's essential to brain development, the interaction with other human beings.
Well, I think you raise an important component, and so many parents believe that, you know, putting their child in front of a computer to learn computer skills early on in life is the right thing to do, and you're suggesting, no, have them interact with people and have the dialogue and the reading and all the other things that are so important. That's what really helps the brain development, and leave the computer for later on.
Correct. And I don't think that intelligence will be measured by the amount of time that a kid spent in front of a computer or how early it started with the computer. I think it will be more important for the child to develop, like you mentioned before, the right synapses in terms of the brain needs to develop a way of reasoning, a way of interacting with our human beings before it can learn anything else. And if that is taken away, then everything else is going to be worthless. No matter how many computers or no matter how many TV programs you're going to offer that child, if the initial part of the first 3 years of life did not have a lot of human interaction, everything else will be worthless.
Wow. Yeah, I think so important for parents. And I know even in my own situation with six grandchildren, you know, with four of them above the age three, what's amazing to me is with, you know, keeping children away from computers and giving them the right sort of interaction from a human standpoint, you know, the four grandchildren are all, by the time they reach age three, are actually reading.
Yep.
And it's quite remarkable the capability and capacity that children have, but I don't think most parents really recognize what that potential is there.
I want to make sure that out of this conversation, that this conversation is not interpreted as we are bashing media and computers, because they all have an important, in this day and age, they play a very important role in educating children, but it all needs to be measured, and parents need to understand that they cannot relegate their responsibility of bringing the brain development of their children to the technology in front of them. But they must use the technology to assist them in creating the brain development of the children. It's not just to sit the kid in front of the computer, but the parent needs to sit with the child in front of the computer, or the parent needs to sit in front of the TV and watch that DVD and help the child to use reason to understand the images that are coming in front or the processes that are needed to utilize the computer.
Oh, that's so critically important, and I appreciate your comment. This is not about, you know, trying to push back on the media or any of the other major stakeholders, because all play an important role in not only childhood development, but education and the whole tools that we use throughout life. And so we want everyone to be partners and engaged and involved. You know, as we think about all this, you know, Dr. Gettysman, you know, you've talked about the role of doctors, and particularly, you know, the role they have as they've got now have to look at all of the system that they're involved in, you know, in terms of how they interact with parents, how they interact with education, data they gather and provide to the parents as they think about, you know, early child development. You know, but there are so many business leaders who are involved in really trying to help either parental education or the overall education system at large. You know, do you have any advice for business leaders as they make decisions about where to invest philanthropic dollars, about areas that you think would be important that maybe business leaders just can't appreciate at this point?
Well, there is no question that the best investment that philanthropy can do will be on the 0-5. California has set a very good example, because we are using the monies, the California people voted, and we're using monies from tobacco tax to be allocated to the Children Family Commission, whose role is to assist in the development of children 0 to 5. And all of that money, which can be equated with philanthropy in other states, is money that goes directed to programs that will help development of children 0 to 5. And I think that that's where I would go, because the future, our future, our future leadership, our future workshop force, our future professional people, our future researchers will depend exclusively on the attention that we pay, for sure, the 0 to 3, better the 0 to 5. And you know how important is that preschool education between 3 and 5. So that's where I would concentrate every possible effort. Other societies are doing that very intensely. Europe is doing that very intensely. The Chinese are doing that very intensely. So we should not lose track of what we are doing with our kids.
Well, and particularly you raise a great point, this early learning, it's where it really all starts, and it provides the foundation for early learning into elementary school, into junior high school, into high school, into college, and eventually in the workforce. And what Elaine and I shall talk about is this continuum of birth to work. It's very, very clear that the healthcare industry, plays such an important role, particularly in helping parents, not only, in the early learning and early development, but also providing the healthcare, for parents. Well, Dr. Gettisman, we have maybe 30 seconds left. Any final comments you'd like to make before we prepare to sign off here on some advice, to give the parents?
Well, my final comment is that I really appreciate you inviting me to be part of this program that you have set up, which I think is a tremendous contribution to the future of our children. And I encourage you to keep this discussion alive and trying to do what I think is critical to any society, which is to bring up children in the best possible way to secure the continuation of this great nation.
Dr. Alberto Gettisman, it is our sincere thanks to you for your leadership, what you're doing not only in Orange County but around the nation, provide us guidance and perspective about how we can work together as parents, as a healthcare industry, to make sure we have the children who are going to be the citizens of the future. When we come back from the break, Elaine and I will provide a perspective about the dialogue we've just had with Dr. Alberto Gettisman and the work that we're doing as part of Birth to Work.
Welcome back to all of you who are joining us for this fourth segment. This is a moment in time that Rick and I have taken to review some of the conversation that we've just had with Dr. Alberto Gettisman, and I am more than pleased to be back in a very comfortable chair with a comfortable microphone rather than sitting on the floor there in the Huntsville, Alabama airport. What was significant about the conversation that we just had with Dr. Gettisman, the fact that it was a rich and fun and full conversation, is meaningful because of the nature of who he is, not just as a pediatrician, but as a human being who is deeply and sincerely concerned about the welfare of kids, more so than just in his practice, but in the whole setting of the community in which he works. And I think I mentioned earlier in the show, we talked about the fact that the first time I met him was through not pediatrics at all. In fact, my girls were older, and I certainly wasn't looking for a doctor, but I was looking for someone who was engaged and involved in teaching young people about the impact of media on kids' ability to think. And he was well ahead of me. He was years ahead of me before I even got involved with it. And I think that's significant, and I bring up that particular point, Rick, because stakeholders are those kinds of people. They see things well ahead of other people, in their field and in their communities. They see things that they know are a problem, and they start to do something about it, not because somebody asked them to, because there was a law passed or because there was a mandate, but they do it because somehow they know it has to be done to make a difference, and Dr. Gettisman is just that kind of doctor.
And Elaine, as I recall, the first time you mentioned, Al, was when you talked about the concept of a media diet. Again, going along your lines about him being ahead, he was actually gathering data as he was trying to understand what was going on with a child development perspective as a pediatrician. As you described, parents were bringing their children in and saying, gee, my child has a particular issue, and he began to start tracking the whole media perspective and the implications it was having on, you know, childhood development from a physical standpoint, from a mental standpoint, from a physiological and psychological standpoint, which to me was a really profound, you know, notion, again, thinking ahead about, you know, what goes on in childhood development. And it fit in directly with all of the early work and discussions you took me through about the importance of parents as first educators with children and the profound impact that parents can have on children in their early years of development.
And I think that that's important because as we move forward and we talk about the notion of bringing health, and we talk a lot about bringing the health community into the discussion of the future of kids doing well in school, because we know that the health community has a significant body of information. They have knowledge, they have insights, they have data about how kids are changing. And the fact that kids are changing and not coming to school, in many cases able to speak or able to hold a pair of scissors in their hands, they're lacking many of the skills and many of the kinds of developmental attributes that kids used to have. And that information, though, unfortunately, is not being very well talked about.
To your point, as I look around at major activities going on in education, who are the three stakeholders that are always there? The three stakeholders are always there: education, government, and business.
Right.
Who are the
but
ones that get left out?
Communities.
One of them is the healthcare industry. Even if people bring in media and community-based organization, it's very rare that healthcare is ever brought to the table.
That's right.
As you pointed out, you know, simple things we think about children, you know, with scissors, children being able to, you know, with rulers, you know, children being able to do those simple things that we all kind of take for granted, you know, as we're growing up. We got to have the healthcare involved in directly understanding what's going on with our children, which become the beginning of the pipeline.
Well, I also think it makes a huge difference to have, I'm going to go out a little further on a limb than I have in the past, because I'm getting up to a place now where I'm beginning to understand that we're so fearful of having certain kinds of conversations about kids. And if you recall, Rick, the number of different ways you and I have approached this issue of trying to build this pipeline of capable people for the future, we're very careful, you know, try not step on any toes. And one of the things that we did, we'll share with our listeners here, we actually had a major opportunity to speak with some key policymakers in Washington about this issue of getting involved and engaged with helping families work with their kids. And we were told, well, you have to stay away from that sort of thing because that's really not the domain of government, that's something that has to be left to the families. And so what it does is it leaves this viewpoint that just a few people can be involved in the conversation of making policy, and all of the other data and facts that surround this issue of what's going on with kids is simply not looked at, or else it's just not covered.
But it's got to be part of the discussion. As we both grew up in our respective communities, we all had to attend classes on sex education, which is about reproduction, how the baby gets in, you know, and the implications associated with that and when the baby comes out. But there is never any discussion about, so what do you do when you have this screaming bundle of joy in your hands and what happens in those first 5 years?
Yeah, but where parents got that information was church. It was the religious community that parents were a member of, and that was taboo to say anything about that. And remember, one of the first things that we learned about child, early parent education for kids was that it was the sort of thing that was enforced by the legal community that was punishing parents, and the only parents who were supposed to get parent education were parents who were bad parents. And that parent education has had a stigma around it for about as long as it's existed. And what we're talking about now is this whole kind of new concept. And Dr. Gettysman was a model, an absolute model for that whole new concept of bringing ideas to parents and bringing things forward that made them or enabled them to be proactive rather than reactive to a lot of the challenges that they're facing, because parents are in an unprecedented moment in time when the decisions that their parents, they can't even go to their parents for a lot of help because a lot of things that they're faced with are not the things that they were, that their parents were faced with. And they have to look to a whole new body of knowledge to understand how to help their kids do well.
But that body of knowledge is significantly more enriched, as we know today, more about the brain. As more scientific evidence, as more a correlation between, you know, how synapses are developed and what it takes in terms of child interaction in the real world, you know, and, you know, the creeping, the crawling, you know, the touching, the multisensory input. Well, I think parents knew that at a time where kids were able to do that more often in their environment because they were outside or engaged. You know, today kids, as you point out many times, tend to be much more restricted in terms of what they're allowed to do because they're in a stroller, they're in a carriage, you know, they're not out in the environment where that multisensory input actually occurs, and that is actually stifling, you know, brain development.
Well, that's not new information, Rick. That information's well over 100 years old. It's just that it was not adopted and not applied. All right, people weren't conscious of it,
The lifestyle has changed as well. The lifestyle has changed from an agrarian society into an urban society, and I think that's where a lot of those opportunities existed. While people knew it, it automatically happened. Today, that's not necessarily happening.
It happened more by default. It was just because they didn't have buggies and they didn't have, you know, all kinds of devices to keep the kids, you know, away from them and to keep them isolated from, you know, the kind of grabbing and holding and moving and playing and everything that they normally did. And I say that because, to be honest with you, Rick, I'm probably more optimistic about the opportunity to help kids do better than 90% of the people or 95% of the people around me, because I know that what we're talking about, what Birth to Work is about, and what our book is about, and what the process we're talking about are not about spending money. They're about understanding how kids actually grow and develop. And we know that we talk to people all across the country. We're talking to some of the finest thinkers and information people, people who know more about this from a larger policy position, a larger education view, and they come back to us and they say, you know, what you're telling us is absolutely true. We just never thought about it that way. And I'd say if there was anything that you could gather from what Birth to Work is about, is thinking about things in ways they hadn't thought about. And we want to let our audience know how excited we are that the numbers continue to rise and more people are listening in. And we're certainly delighted to have the kind of feedback we're getting, that people said we just enjoy a conversation that's non-polarizing, that's really not about figuring out who to blame, but figuring out how to take more responsibility, get engaged, and make a difference.
Well, we had a terrific show with Al, and really this whole notion about child development and the importance of parents involved in child development. You know, as we continue our dialogue, certainly many will see us as we pull our stakeholders together. We always have to include the healthcare industry as part of that dialogue.
We must. And I would say for our listeners, this is not about early child education. This is about early parent education. So that parents are clear about what to go do. It's not the kid who's the problem. It's the opportunity that parents have to really understand what works, and we're excited to be at the forefront of that. We look forward to talking with you again next week. This is Elaine Scott.
And Rick Stevens.
And this is Birth to Work Radio.
Thank you for joining us on Birth to Work Radio. For more information about Birth to Work, to stream or download podcasts of archived radio programs, or to purchase a hard copy or downloadable version of Rick and Elaine's book, The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, please visit our website at birthtowork.org. That's birth, the number two, work.org. We invite you to send us your feedback and questions directly by emailing info@birthtowork.org. Birth to Work Radio, the voice of community stakeholder leaders.